Friday, jobs day of a Fed week and a global trade, year now, I guess. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the first day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Not for the first time since January the 20th, 2 years ago. I will point out that while the political news has gotten most of the headlines this week, it is the economic news that is really going to matter when all is said and done. So that is what we are going to do this week in This Economy. We're going to do it with Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. They are in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lynette, Jobs Day Friday, as I said, 304,000 new jobs last month. Unemployment rate ticked up a bit, but that's fine. Here's what I want to know. How come, with the economy slowing, as virtually everybody agrees it is or will soon start to do, how come jobs are still so strong?
It looks like consumer confidence and consumer spending is still working, still healthy. And with 68% of our economy being consumer spending, domestic spending, I guess that's still keeping us going through all of this. And I think, you know, we're starting to hear about layoffs, and we have since December. I think those will really start to kick in during the first quarter. And, you know, we'll see how it goes. But, yeah, yabba dabba do.
So, Lee, we're going to do wages here in a minute, Lee, with Justin Ho. But what I want to know from you is, at what point do you think this kind of job growth becomes, I don't want to say, you know, second nature, but we stop sort of seeing this stuff and going, oh, my goodness, this is still going 10 years into this recovery?
Well, I think there's a few things to keep in mind. I mean, one is the slowdown, the economic slowdown that we keep talking about. It's largely global, and we're talking about the U.S. job market, which itself is very regional. You have widely varying job rates state by state, depending on what's going on. We certainly saw that during the shale boom, and et cetera. Yeah. So that's one point. And then the other thing is, I mean, the unemployment is typically, I hate to say this, but it's a lagging indicator. Yep. So, you know, leading indicators are things like bond yields, housing starts, things like that. So, you know, unemployment may be the last thing to go when, you know, things start to turn in our economy.
Yeah, well, so look, I mean, bond yields are you know, down-ish from where they've been, not monumentally, right? And housing starts are slowing. So if you look at the leading indicators, It's there are signs, I don't want to be doom and gloom here, but
no, but I think that's why people are worried. And then, of course, you've had all this market volatility that we had since December, that will actually maybe scare consumers, because as Lynette pointed out, the consumer confidence and consumer spending has been really strong, and so, you know, that could be at risk.
So to the volatility, Lynette, I want to just briefly pause for Jerome Powell, the chair of the Fed. This week he came out and he used a word which everybody went, oh my goodness, this means we're fine, and he said that the Fed is prepared to be patient on interest rates. And I wonder if you think Mr. Powell heard the markets last month when he was less calming and now has not learned his lesson, but is being more mindful.
Well, I certainly think that the Fed's mandate is always to watch and look at the data. And I think that that's just what he's doing. I mean, you know, in terms of markets and the entire world, things are not looking good. And he needs to make sure that this doesn't trickle into our unemployment, into wages, into the things that really matter for Americans. I just think he's doing his job. I didn't think anything strange about that. You know, data dependent and all that, and everybody freaks out about it. It's not, but that is exactly it. That's what he was doing.
So the other thing about Powell, and I'll get off him in a second here, Lee, but I just want to pivot with him on this question. He kept talking about cross currents, right? Cross currents in the global economy, which you talked about. Do you take any solace from the China trade talks that happened at the White House this week, and any sign that anything's going to happen before we really get down to it at the end of February, when the president has said he's going to bump up those tariffs?
Right, with the 90-day deadline. Yeah, it certainly seems like not much progress was made, although, Robert Lighthizer said that, what were his words, that just because things didn't come off the rails, that's a good sign. I do think it's in the long-term interest of both countries to resolve things, and certainly in the short-term interest to resolve this immediate deadline. There was a theory that the Chinese may have felt back in the fall that it would be better to negotiate after the midterms, because right before them, Trump would just want to appeal to his political base and continue to be harmful to China, yeah. but and that he may be more open to compromise now. But I mean, you know, I think we have to see. I mean, right. I think 2020 plays into this a lot.
And, oh, for sure.
But most people seem to think that there will be a deal. But there's two things. There's the long-term deal, and then there's this very short-term deal, which is, you know, it's a nice parallel to the government shutdown.
Yeah. Well, I think the debate is it a real deal, or is it a deal that Donald Trump can go and tell his base about and that doesn't really have any long-term impacts on, yeah. you know, the Chinese economy. And so that to me is the question. Will Trump take a fake deal or not?
Well, let me squeeze you.
And if he's
you.
Not going to take a fake deal, this might take a little bit longer.
Let me squeeze you a little bit. What do you think he's going to do?
What do I think he's going to do? I think that Xi Jinping asking for Trump to go to, you know, to see Trump and talk to him right. and take the measure of him is Xi Jinping trying to understand whether or not Trump will take a fake deal. And of course, the fact that none of Trump's surrogates can actually speak for him.
Right.
You know, he makes decisions on a whim, and you think you've got him saying yes, and all of a sudden he says no, and none of his, you know, surrogates can actually answer.
And everybody's betwixt in between, right?
Right. But it's definitely in China's best interest not to make these long-term measures and, you know, just to make ceremonial gestures.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. Stay warm
Bye, Kai.
Out there on the East Coast, would you?
You too.
Oh, I will. It's L.A. Come on. A quick detour into pharmaceuticals here before we go on. You might have seen stories the past couple of days about Purdue Pharma and OxyContin, its highly addictive opioid painkiller. Stories saying the company had been promoting opioids as a low addiction risk and also was looking hard for new ways to profit from them. That's according to a lawsuit just made public by the state of Massachusetts, also reported out by ProPublica. But to really understand how the opioid epidemic started, as well as Purdue's role in it, you got to listen to our podcast. It's called The Uncertain Hour. They did a great job with it. On Wall Street this Friday, green. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, as promised, we're going to do another couple of minutes here on that jobs report, wages specifically. Average pay went up 3.2% last month compared to a year earlier. January was the fourth straight month where yearly wage growth topped 3%, which is good and also about time because we have been hearing about sluggish wage growth for years now. But do 4 months a difference make? Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
Back in June, a reporter asked Fed Chair Jay Powell about whether wages would finally pick up, especially with companies struggling to find workers.
Everywhere we go now, we hear about labor shortages, but where's the wage reaction? So it's a bit of a puzzle.
That was June. Ever since, wages have been rising on average. Economist Sarah House at Wells Fargo says with the unemployment rate still so low, companies have to do something.
The laws of supply and demand have not been replaced, so as labor has become increasingly scarce, employers are beginning to pay up more for that.
That's showing up the most in low-paying industries like food service. Martha Gimbel is the director of hiring research at the job site Indeed.com.
So what that means is that a lot of the workers who really most need a pay raise are the ones getting one.
But raises at the bottom aren't necessarily substantive raises, says labor economist Teresa Ghilarducci at the New School.
When you increase the wages of somebody who's paid near the minimum wage, that nickel or 10 cents an hour is going to look like a big increase.
Given how low the unemployment rate is, she says pay for middle-class workers should be growing too. But looking at the report, pay in certain middle-income industries like manufacturing is still pretty stagnant.
In goods-producing jobs, those are jobs in manufacturing-related industries. Those are usually middle-class jobs. That pay has not increased.
For a healthy economy, she says pay has to pick up in those types of jobs. Until that happens, the wage puzzle remains unsolved. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Another labor and job story now, this one through an immigration lens. If you're a skilled foreign worker with an advanced degree from an American college or university, your chances of getting the visa you need to work in this country, say in Silicon Valley, they're about to get better. The lottery that governs how those visas, H-1Bs they're called, are allocated, is being retooled. The number of them stays the same, but this week the Trump administration announced changes that will give more of them to those highly skilled graduates I was talking about. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
Right now, there are 85,000 H-1B visas given out each year in a two-step lottery. First, 20,000 visas are awarded to applicants from a pool of foreign workers with advanced degrees. Those who don't make it join a second pool of applicants without advanced degrees. And another 65,000 winners are picked. Starting in April,
what they're doing is they're going to reverse that order.
That's Ron Hira, a political science professor at Howard University. He says the switch will mean more than 5,300 new visas going to foreign workers with advanced degrees. Hira says the change will benefit employers all around, but especially those in tech, like
the semiconductor industry, which is in the heart of Silicon Valley.
The new rules could also pay off for universities. Sarah Pierce is with the Migration Policy Institute.
This could possibly increase enrollment of foreign nationals at institutions of higher education, which is a little ironic because they've actually seen falling rates of enrollment of international students.
But outsourcing firms, which place lower-skilled foreign workers in U.S. companies, may sue over the new rules. Daniel Costa is an immigration lawyer and policy expert.
They're worried about not being able to get the exact workers that they want.
In April 2020, the application process is expected to be streamlined. Based on her experience with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, immigration attorney Nell Barker is skeptical.
All of this assumes that the function of the system assumes that USCIS is going to timely process cases.
She says last spring, her law firm submitted nearly 300 H-1B applications. Some are still out for review. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The world's biggest online retailer had one of those days today. Good news followed by a cold, hard dose of reality. Amazon announced quarterly profits yesterday, and while, yes, it did beat estimates, the company acknowledged growth is slowing both here and internationally. It's not going to help at all, though, that there are regulations that went into effect in India today, significantly dimming Amazon's prospects there. Rules that prevent foreign companies, think Amazon and Walmart subsidiary Flipkart, from finding exclusive partners and then selling their products online at a discount. Sound familiar? Marketplace's Ben Bradford explains that particular global trade roadblock.
Overnight, thousands of products disappeared from Amazon's India website, including its Echo and Fire TV. Amazon CFO Brian Olsavsky used the reserved tone classic to earnings calls to express his displeasure.
We've built our business around price selection and convenience. We don't think the changes help in those dimensions.
Amazon has since found a way to get some products online, but analysts say the rule could undercut its growth in India.
Its ability to be the leading online retail company, that's now in question.
RBC analyst Mark Mahaney says it's not a huge problem short term, but the company planned to spend over $5 billion on its India business for a reason. Walmart spent more than $15 billion buying the Indian company Flipkart to compete there.
India is obviously a very large market in terms of people. It's a reasonably large market in terms of spend. If you want to be a global company, you should try to have a presence there.
But Indian retailers are understandably not thrilled about foreign behemoths coming in and offering steeply discounted products. Brookings Institute researcher Tanvi Madan says the government is responding in an election year.
They've only just started to kind of put some of these policies in place, and the government has said that that is partly the intention of these rules is to make more space for Indian companies.
She says India is taking a protectionist page from its neighbor China, where homegrown e-commerce giant Alibaba has edged out Amazon. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the global tech economy, Facebook turns 15 on Monday, which got us thinking about the social networks that have come and gone, or at least aren't used as much in the decade and a half since then. MySpace, I'm looking at you. Share your comments on what you used and how social might have changed your life at marketplace.org. Coming up.
We went to a Costco in Tokyo, and sliced beef tongue actually costs more per pound than a T-bone steak.
What's the matter? Costco got your tongue? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 64 points today, more than a quarter percent, 25,000 to 63. The NASDAQ down 17, about a quarter percent, 72.63. The S&P 500 up 2 points. We'll call that really flat, 27.06. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow and the NASDAQ each added about 1.33%. The S&P 500 rose 1.5%. Mentioned Amazon has run into a roadblock in India with some tough new e-commerce rules there. Investors had expected that company to deliver better news about its prospects for revenue growth, as investors do. Amazon down more than 5% today. The energy sector steered into the fast lane after two big players, ExxonMobil and Chevron, reported strong quarterly profits, beating expectations. One reason, pumped up production in the North American Permian Basin shale oil fields. Andy Euler's done some reporting there for us. ExxonMobil up 2.6% today. Chevron found 3.7%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.68%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood here, and I want you to listen to the latest episode of Make Me Smart, the show all about tech, the economy, and culture. This week, we get smart about the longest government shutdown in history and how we got here to a place where we've had three major government shutdowns since 1995. So is it time to shut down the shutdowns once and for all?
You know, the comment I've made before is that this should be the three strikes and you're out for government shutdowns. 95, 96, 2013, and then 2018, 2019. Mm. Why do we want to repeat it?
Make Me Smart. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Now that the government's back up and running, for the time being anyway, there are a couple of global trade items on the to-do list. China talks were this week, as we mentioned, and as we've been telling you. Now, Japan. President Trump has been going round and around with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe about bilateral negotiations. They could have started as early as January the 20th, but shut down. In the meanwhile, though, a new trade deal between Japan and the European Union goes into effect today. You throw that in with a new, not including America, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and there is a whole lot going on in the Western Pacific that the United States is not a part of. Thing is, Japan's a big export market for us, agriculture in particular. So some U.S. meat producers are kind of on edge, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Last spring, Ashley Coles found herself in Tokyo, standing around a Weber-style grill, cooking some thick American steaks, while Japanese chefs and social media foodies looked on.
Teaching them how to take larger cuts of meat and bringing them to where they have grills in these parks, teaching folks how to go and use these grills to have the similar experience as what we would have here if we were grilling out in our backyard.
Coles is a cattle producer and head of Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. She was part of a trade mission to tout the benefits of U.S. beef. Before this trip, she didn't really think of herself as an exporter.
We really don't know for sure when we send them to a packer or a processor what the final market will be for those animals.
Japan is famous for its premium meats, like its beautifully marbled Kobe beef. But it's also an important export destination for U.S. beef. The U.S. Export Federation estimates the U.S. exported more than $2 billion of beef to Japan last year, often parts of the cow that Americans don't typically eat.
We went to a Costco in Tokyo, and sliced beef tongue actually costs more per pound than a T-bone steak.
In fact, the U.S. sells more beef to Japan than it does to any other country. Problem is,
all of our competitors in the Japanese market are now going to face a lower tariff rate than where we are.
Kent Backus is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. His big concern is Australia, the main competitor for U.S. beef in Japan. Both countries used to face the same roughly 40% tariff when selling to Japan. But thanks to trade agreements Australia signed, its tariff will drop each year for 15 years until it gets to 9%. The U.S. will be stuck at that nearly 40% rate unless it makes a new trade deal of its own.
The saving grace for us right now is the fact that Australia is going through a terrible drought. But it will rain again in Australia someday, and those pastures will recover. Their herd numbers will grow. And at that point, Australian beef will become much more competitive. The price point will be at a point where we just can't match it.
The lower price doesn't necessarily mean Japanese buyers will forsake American products for Australian ones. That's according to Andrew Muhammad, a professor at the University of Tennessee Institute of Agriculture. He's tried to model the effects of these tariffs and says as the Japanese continue to buy more red meat, that growth will go to the countries with the lower tariffs.
we did find a clear gain for Australian beef in Japan.
As in $100 million to $400 million a year in additional exports.
If the U.S. is unable to negotiate an agreement with the Japanese government and gain equivalent market access for U.S. beef as Australia has already gained, and then there is a potential lost opportunity.
A lost opportunity of about $300 million a year for U.S. producers. And it's not just beef. European pork producers have a similar edge thanks to the new EU-Japan trade agreement. So the clock is ticking. The U.S. is just starting talks with Japan, and trade agreements can take years to work out. There's this peer pressure element to them. As other countries create agreements to lower tariffs, the U.S. needs to negotiate similar deals just to keep up. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Raise your hand if you've ever looked up something called a Zestimate, the best guess, data derived to be sure of what a particular home is worth. My hand is raised, by the way. The online real estate company Zillow crunches data from users, and it takes market conditions and location into account as it comes up with said Zestimate. Margins of error matter, though, in data science, so the company did a contest, $1 million prize, to whoever figured out how to improve its Zestimate algorithms the most. Jordan Meyer is a data scientist, also a member of the winning team. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, congratulations on the big win. How did this come to pass? First of all, how'd you find out about the contest?
Well, it was kind of hard to miss, I guess, $1 million prize in the data science community certainly raises some eyebrows.
All right. So for the lay people among us, explain to me how you did this. I mean, everybody's pretty much familiar with Zillow. They've got this estimate. They grind some numbers. They wanted to make it better, and you said, I can do that, you and your teammates. How?
Well, they gave us about 10 years of data for about 10 million houses in the United States.
Wow.
And we crunched that data using several different machine learning techniques, combined our models together, and then got the Zestimate error rate down from about 4.5% to 4%.
I'm going to ask another layperson question here. Is that a lot, 4.5% to 4%?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a 13% reduction in error. Those are generally pretty hard to come by when you have a sophisticated, mature model like the Zestimate.
Tell me why it matters then. Why does a more accurate Zestimate make a difference?
Well, I think for most people, their home is probably the most significant investment of their lives. And so, you know, having the information that you might need to make an informed decision there, mm-hmm. especially making sure that that is accurate, is going to help a lot of people, you know, invest wisely.
Yeah. Was this a trial and error thing that you guys did? I mean, you set up an algorithm and you crunched some numbers and you saw what happened and then you went back and did it again?
Oh, yeah. I mean, relentlessly. It was just, I think my teammate Nima Shabazi said, for every idea that worked, there were 100 that didn't work, but we kept going. I'd say that's pretty spot on.
How much time did this take away from your day job, man?
Oh, well, in the last month of the competition, all three of us pretty much went to about 0 hours with work. So I think we're all estimating something around 400 hours each for the full length of the competition.
Wow. Is there a limit to how good this estimate can get? I mean, you got yourself a 13% reduction, and obviously the company benefits. Could it get to, I don't know, 2%?
I think 2% might be pushing it. I mean, there's certainly some randomness that we'll never be able to control. There's probably people who see a house and it reminds them of their childhood home, and there's no way an algorithm could ever anticipate that and how much they'd be willing to pay. But I do think there's probably still room for improvements, and I'm sure Zillow's going to be working on that.
$1 million prize split three ways. You get $300,000+, and then you got to pay taxes. And then what are you going to do with your money, man?
Well, I'm currently spending my evenings browsing Zillow for investment properties.
Of course you are. Do you trust? All right, here's the question. Do you trust the Zestimate?
I do. I mean, it was extremely difficult to get improvements over the Zestimate. So I now have some insight into what small things I can consider that might help me mentally adjust.
Fair enough. Jordan Meyer, he's a data scientist and also the winner of the Zillow Prize. Jordan, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, by way of researchers at Stanford and New York University, they paid people $102 to turn off their Facebook accounts for 4 weeks and then asked them some questions. It turns out being off Facebook makes people who are not on Facebook, they were less politically polarized, but also less informed. So might I humbly suggest in that vein, public radio, you know, we'll do podcasts too. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 64 today, more than 0.25%. NASDAQ down 17, about 0.25%. S&P 500 basically flat. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday. All right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.